Welcome to Growing E-Commerce. I'm your host, Mike Ryan of Smarter E-Commerce, also known as SMEC. Today, I'm joined by Onur Polat, a senior product manager at Adidas, and sometimes I call that Adidas since I'm here in the German-speaking market. And he's responsible for Adidas's global ad tech and paid traffic product efforts. We discuss his career from bootstrapping a jobs portal in Albania to working in corporate environments like Criteo, and scale-ups like Chanable. From there, we talk about everything from feed-based advertising to product management and horizontal initiatives to the interplay of CMO, CTO, and CFO. It's an expansive conversation with someone who has a lot to teach. All right, let's get into it. So thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks, Mike.
Absolutely. Why don't you get started with a quick introduction? What are your skills? What themes interest you?
My skills. I think I would say my biggest skill is putting science into practice. And I guess that's both the reason why I became an engineer in the first place. And that's also why I really love doing it. A bit about myself. I was raised in Turkey. I went to a special high school, which was designed to raise scientists. But at some point in time, it came to me that we have a lot of science, but we don't really always leverage all the science in practice. And that's when I started to lose my interest in pursuing that. And that's when I turned to engineering, because I really wanted to focus on building things for the people. And that pretty much defined my career. And talking about the careers, I think I have a somewhat awkward career trajectory. Most people start their careers in an enterprise setting or in a company setting, and then at some point in time they get bored and they start their businesses. Right? They go for a startup. We did the opposite with my brother. The year I started university, we also started our own startup. That startup was mostly around the internet in general. One of the biggest highlights from that experience is we built a creation of news sources, online news resources for Turkey. I did a lot of search engine optimization at the time, and at some point in time, it hit 500,000 visitors per day. So that was amazing. That's when I also started to focus on the monetization side of the things. And more and more, I got lured into this digital advertising space. So both the organic side of the things, but then as we started to monetize those properties, I got also experience around the ad tech space. Once we had some cash to put aside, we wanted to try something else, and we wanted it to be at a national level. But Turkey is a very big country to attempt to do something at the national level. Then we picked Albania, a relatively smaller country. And there we built a job portal / resume database before LinkedIn was really a thing. My brother still manages it. I think it's still the biggest job portal in the country. But the thing is, it didn't really scale up as much as I wanted it to grow. And after like 15 years, I turned into a corporate scale-up career, if you will. So in the past 9 years, I have worked at advertising platforms like Criteo. I was a contractor for Facebook for a time. Then I got more and more into the product side of the things. I managed an internal product for the creative agency for SEAT, which was around dynamic creative optimization. And then my path took me to the Netherlands. I moved to the Netherlands with Chernobyl as a platform partnerships manager. I would say that was really a turning point in my career, but we can talk about it later. And now I'm at Adidas, and as a global sports company, we believe that through sport we have the power to change lives. And I really love this purpose. I have started doing more sports recently, and I do observe it firsthand, all the change that it brings to my life. But this doesn't mean I didn't really do sports. I was always a diehard walker. Maybe an interesting fact, I walked the Marathon of Athens like 15 years ago. So that's basically 42 kilometers, 195 meters. I walked it in 6 hours and 58 minutes.
That's awesome. I mean, so, I think walking is good for the mind as well as the body. I'm a big fan of walking as well.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe that's another skill from my side. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And I like this kind of framing that you like, you know, describing kind of taking science and putting it into practice, and then having this career of building things, coming into the monetization space, Criteo, as you mentioned, Chernobyl. Maybe you could tell us a bit more about your time at Chernobyl. You know, what kind of work were you doing there? You said that was a turning point in your career. How did you mean that? What did you learn there? What happened?
Yeah. So for the people who don't know about Chernobyl, it's a feed management platform based in Utrecht, Netherlands. I think they are now almost 10 years old. And I think they are at like 250 employee count. When I started working there 3.5 years ago, I might have been employee number 100. So they were still a bit smaller, but still a scale up. And I was brought in as a platform partnerships manager, reporting directly into the CEO. Like I said, it was about time they were truly becoming a strong scale-up. They had a great foundation with their products, and they had a great client base. What was missing was the key partnerships with the platforms for which they were actually creating the feeds, right? Because you can generate feeds for Google Merchant Center, for Facebook, for Snapchat, or any platform that offers some kind of dynamic product ads. So there was this gap across all functions, I would say. And there was a gap for the product partnerships. They were usually trying to make sense of all the online documentation, but they didn't have a one-on-one interaction with the engineers of these platforms. Similarly, there was a gap for the product marketing. Even though they were actually enabling these platforms, they weren't really doing much of co-marketing activity per se. Mm-hmm. So that was another gap. And lastly, it was also the official recognition, right? Becoming official partners to these platforms was an important goal. And in my role, I had a chance to work on all these. Some highlights include getting the Facebook Marketing Partner badge for Chernobyl. We were the first commerce partner for Meta in the Netherlands. So quite a few highlights like that with Microsoft, with Google and such. A big shout out to the CEO, Rob van Unen. He's the best boss I have ever had outside my family. I have to, because my mom might listen to this. And It was an amazing journey. It really helped me put all my previous skills, right? Everything I brought from entrepreneurship, but also all the background I had with all those advertising platforms. It was really a great melting pot for me, where I could really transfer and combine all these experience, all these learnings, and put it into to great use. So in that sense, I'm really grateful that I had that experience.
Chanables is a company that they've been around for quite a while, as you mentioned. I just wanted to like follow up on this topic about feeds a bit, because I think it is such an interesting area in e-commerce, in advertising. It's at the intersection of these different spaces, where your product feed is actually kind of a data product. Like it's a foundation upon which other things are going to be built. And I think that becomes increasingly important these days because, there's these criticisms about Google Ads becoming a bit more black box or quite black box, and other channels all will follow suit. Like Meta has their Advantage Plus shopping campaigns, TikTok, even I think Snap, all going in this direction of like these very highly automated campaigns. So I think that data that you're then feeding into that platform is as important or more than ever. I mean, maybe you could tell us a bit about product feeds, like also what kind of decisions go into that regarding build or buy decisions. How do the needs of, say, an enterprise differ from needs of others? Like, tell us about the significance of feeds a bit.
I think it's a great question. And I think, first take not a step back, but a step to the side, because you mentioned an interesting concept of the black box, right? So more and more platforms are moving in this direction. And AI is the hype, right? The thing is, all these platforms invest heavily in building these black boxes to serve their end clients and to make their own clients successful. And I think they are generally doing a great job. And I don't think we are now going to go into whether this black box approach is healthy or not. I'll probably leave it to another discussion. But let's just think about what happens when you have a black box. So some data or some input goes into a black box, and then some output comes out, right? The thing is, regardless of what happens in a black box, the quality of the output is a function of your input. It doesn't matter. Like, I mean, how cool Google's AI is, how well Facebook optimizes, it all starts with your input. Speaking in engineering terms, there's a concept called garbage in, garbage out, right? So if you don't feed high quality input to any black box or any platform, what you will get cannot meet your expectations. So in that sense, and that's the reason why a product feed is called a feed, right? I mean, you actually feed it into a machine learning algorithm. So in that sense, I feel that sometimes the importance of product feeds is a bit underestimated. I think most people try to focus on what happens within the black box or all those fancy settings you have on all these interfaces. And they tend to forget the importance of that very basic input you feed into the platforms. So in that sense, moving to the second half of your question, around the buy or build decision, I would say companies, pretty much regardless of their size, I mean, maybe I'll exclude very small businesses, with relatively stable count of articles, I would say most enterprises should build the capabilities to generate their source feeds or the raw input themselves. And then when it comes to passing these raw feeds to multiple channels for which you would need customizing, I would, again, at a high level, I would encourage enterprises or companies of all sizes to really look into the commercial offerings, which comes from platforms like Chainable, Data Feed Watch. I don't know. I hear, I think ROI Hunter, they do things, Intelligent Reach. There are a couple of platforms, right? So there are some really cool tools which help you modify and customize your feeds. So by all means, use them to your advantage. There's no point in reinventing the wheel, right? These platforms do a great job to process your raw feed and then to customize it to the channels. But in my opinion, the biggest part of the magic happens with your source feed, source input. And this, in my view, should be handled in-house. And why is that? The thing is, your team is the only team who can make sense of, or an internal team is the only team, only player who can make sense of what matters for your business when it comes to product feeds, so that whatever data, whatever information you need to leverage is actually included in the feeds. If you use a standard commercial package, which also claims, you can click a product feed with three clicks, you will most probably end up with a very generic feed, which actually cannot give you the edge. It's as simple as that. And it's 2023, right? And I've been around for a long time when it comes to internet and digital advertising. For a considerable amount of time, having a strong digital presence was enough to give companies an edge, right? Because the other companies were not able to catch up. They were not able to digitalize their efforts, et cetera, et cetera. That trend has long gone, right? Now, pretty much everyone is online. Everybody is advertising online. And in order to get those 5%, 10%, 8% incrementality, you really need to focus on your internal product data and how you can incorporate it in a meaningful way to make the most out of all those black boxes, all those advertising platforms to the maximum. So that's how I would answer.
Yeah, so it makes sense. And I mean, I had to ask you that question because I know you're a builder. And it's just, it's so you're talking about, you know, making sure that this raw source is coming from you and is customized, and then leaving the kind of feed syndication and customization to a service provider. I'm wondering, because now we're headed in a really interesting direction with some of this new technology. As you mentioned, it's 2023 now, and we have increasingly Google, and I'm sure soon to follow others. But in the first place, I would say Google is pretty advanced here. They're working on trying to kind of offer tools to supplement your feed, but also workarounds to the feed altogether. So some of these products include, we could look at things that are on the supplementation side, like Product Studio. This is, I don't think it's even launched yet. It was announced at Google Marketing Live a couple months back, and that's really to help your product images. It uses AI to enhance your images. Like, you can swap out backgrounds instead of using a stock image, you can just and having to do that in Photoshop or some other tool. Right there in the merchant center, you can have generative AI create whatever background you want. And then, like, probably the biggest, most ambitious, and I think this is something they've wanted to do for years, but with Merchant Center Next, they're looking at bypassing the feed altogether, where you can offer, you know, a URL, for example. AI will read the page and will just produce its own, like, you don't need the feed at all. I mean, like, what do you think about, Given what you said about the need to have competitive advantage via your feed, the importance of the input quality into a black box, the increasing competitiveness, the importance of expressing what you know about your business, all these things that you said, like, how do you feel about these AI tools in that context?
AI is the hype, right? So I think we had no option to, we had no choice but to talk about it. So I think some of these developments are really interesting, especially for smaller businesses. On a lower budget, right? I mean, if you don't have a big budget to produce, especially visual assets, I think options like generating images with AI could be attractive. Now, the thing is, and I mean, don't take me wrong. I'm, like I said, I really enjoy putting science into practice, right? I mean, that's, I would say, what summarizes my entire career. So I was playing with AI. Let's take a bit of a side tour. I was playing with AI. So I went into the Bing image generator. I think they use some version of DALL-E. And I said, okay, I'll keep this really simple. Because I mean, I really don't have the time to go into all those documentation and I don't know, the prompt engineering. I just want to introduce myself in an easy way. And being the simple-minded person I am, what I put on the generator's input box was postcard for 2024. And the images I got out, none of them had 2024 anywhere on the image.
Yeah.
And that was, to be honest, very surprising to me because, you would know this, I mean, I spend a lot of time on LinkedIn. I think even though there are a lot of people who are posting similar content, I think it's still an important source of truth, especially given competition looks like Twitter. And I see all these really, not necessarily thought leaders, but I see all these people who hold great positions in great companies. They keep talking about the AI. And I was very surprised to see that such a simple prompt couldn't produce anything interesting. Like I was just trying to make a joke in one of our meetings, and I just needed a postcard for 2024. I couldn't get it. So going from that example to actually using all these technologies in production, and especially for larger enterprises where the brand concerns are really big, I'm really not sure how quickly this could be used at scale. My point of view is all this AI, all the generative AI, I think it's like a 10x, 15x multiplier for individual people's creativity. But I still see the human element in the loop. So if you ask me, do you think by using these AI-based technologies, can agencies deliver more potent feeds 10 times faster? Can you create 5 A-B tests instead of 1 A-B test in the same time period? It would have been a solid yes from my side. But if the question is around whether we could immediately plug and play these, I have my concerns. And like I said, these concerns, they are less of a concern for smaller businesses and more of a concern with enterprise. At the same time, I'm also thinking maybe instead of using these offers from platforms like Google or Facebook, I think the enterprises might be also in a good position to access these models themselves. and to use them, not necessarily isolated to a specific channel, but for all their activities, including the on-site experience, right? So I would say that that's what I think about it. I think a human still needs to read and approve all these things for, and it will be like that for quite some time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. And I mean, well, there's some different things to address there, but I mean, Google is also making some AI available for on-site search, for example, like Vertex AI. They have a recommendation AI. They have on-site search AI for people using their cloud solution. But there's, yeah, you know, there's something about having these things because they're not really, yeah, they're very specifically designed for you, to facilitate your use of their ad platforms. And, you know, to an extent, that's fair enough. But, you know, I just think there's a missed opportunity where, like, people used to look at the search terms report in Google Ads and get data that for other topics in their business. You know, there was this idea to turn data from channel data from Google Ads and learn more of that for the business or across the business. And I think you can still do that, but to a certain extent. But it does, the way that they build their product, things are just very much locked into the UI. And there's this, you know, sometimes they're adding new reports or insights, but, you know, they're not exportable the way you might expect or not. Yeah, it's just, it's an interesting choice of theirs. But
And here's the thing. We also want the experience to feel holistic, right? Mm-hmm. So if I see an ad, after I click the ad, when I land on a website or an app, I want that transition to be smooth. So yeah. If I see a certain background on the ad, and if I see a completely different looking pair of shoes on the product detail page, I'm not sure if that's great, right? So, like I said, so maybe for smaller businesses, it's better than not having some kind of journey at all. But a lot of mid and large enterprises, they spend a lot of time. They spend a lot of effort and energy and resources on building these storylines, right? Mm. In that sense, I have my reservations for the time.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. It's not necessarily end-to-end. And maybe Google will address that. I mean, I think that they're aware of the importance of, you know, expectations between ad click and landing page and stuff like that. But feels a bit open. To your point that this is probably a better fit for smaller businesses than enterprise, I agree with you. And I think Google sort of agrees with that as well. Like from at Google Marketing Live, they had sort of mentioned that, I've got a quote, the features of Merchant Center that larger retailers know and love won't be going anywhere, and that they're committed to rolling out the new version at a responsible pace. When users, yeah, basically that there's going to be feature parity and stuff like that. So, you know, it sounds like they're taking it seriously. But I'm also a bit skeptical of these solutions. I think you mentioned earlier kind of in the loop. And yeah, there's always, people talk about in the loop and out of the loop. And I think that there's a third position there as well, which is kind of being like on the loop where, you know, you're not taking direct controls or like it's a very highly automated system, but you're still in this very much a supervisory or editorial capacity. And I think that's a position we'll be spending a lot of time sitting in the months and years ahead is in this kind of editorial position. But
yeah. I mean, since AI is the hot topic, I think I might sound like the grumpy uncle here. But another thing I expect to happen is also, I think as more and more of the general population understands about generative AI, I think soon we'll also get to a point where people will literally pick up the phone and they will ask the website support, is it the image I'm looking at? Is it the real photo of the product or is it generated?
Yeah.
I mean, this will come, right? I think that's also, I mean, based on all my previous life experience, right? Not as a product manager, but as a consumer, I think we'll also get to that point. People that will get more and more suspicious. It's like, I mean, how many of us enjoy talking to chatbots on the website? It was cool for a time. Why? Because you thought you were talking to a real person. Mm-hmm. And then now we all know it's not a real person.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's the tricky part. And I think we all need to be very responsible how we implement these things, because it might also become a missed opportunity if this is not, if this is abused and not addressed properly.
Yeah, it's a good point. Again, like on that kind of end-to-end note, just really considering the customer and having a lot of empathy for the customer experience there, I think is really important. So that's been a good discussion about feeds, which came out of part of your recent past in your career. Thanks for sharing that. Now I'd like to talk about your current role a bit. And we get back toward this topic of building a bit again, I guess. But like, can you give us an overview of the work you're doing, of your team? And yeah, I'd love to hear about that.
Yeah. So my team is called the Paid Traffic Product Team. It's part of a bigger traffic team, which also includes the organic traffic. I have a great counterpart there, Derek Mayen, a great SEO product manager. And then as a whole, we are part of the consumer engagement within the Adidas digital products. And what it means when we say a product team is, so it's basically a product manager and a solutions architect and a few engineers. And we are completely dedicated with our time in relationship to paid traffic activities. So this is mostly around performance marketing, but all paid traffic activities within the digital space falls under our scope. And as a tech-oriented team, we basically support our markets with the tech capabilities they need to be. They need to be really successful at what they do, which is really the performance marketing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for that introduction. So, I mean, I think one of the reasons I wanted to bring you on is because I find this idea of like having a product manager role in this context really interesting. And I think part of it might come from the enterprise scale. It could be one of the reasons why, but I think it's also just a difference in philosophy and approach. Like, how does being an internal product team or being a PM, how does that differ from a classic IT approach where other companies might put something on the IT backlog or they're waiting for some capability support from IT? How does it differ with a product approach?
Yeah, no, I think it's a good point. I think we really have to talk about the very basics of product management to talk about it. I would say with the IT team approach, the problem belongs to the user. And they have to come up with a solution, and then they have to request the solution and somebody just executes it. And the person, the IT team, which executes this, they're like, oh, okay, this is my ticket. I've done what I was asked to do in the ticket. That's it. Move to the next ticket. Whereas when you talk about product teams or product management, it's the product team which owns the problem. And by constantly interacting with our users who suffer from these problems or these challenges, we invent on their behalf. So I think this really summarizes it well. This is one of the phrases I really love about product management: inventing on behalf of your users.
Yeah, I like that phrase. I haven't heard that one. Is that trademarked to you, or?
I'm pretty sure I heard it somewhere. It might be even Steve Jobs.
I don't know, but it's a good one.
Yeah, I really like it. I also don't remember where I heard it. And as a product team, that's what we try to do, right? We really try to understand our users, and our users would also come to us with all kinds of requests. They would also think a certain way to solve a problem is the best way. And that's also welcome, right? But we also try to understand what it is that exactly challenging them. And then we try to come up with creative solutions to address that. And if you also think about all the products we use, I really doubt a user could have defined an iPhone at the time, right? I mean, you had bits and pieces here and there. Like, okay, I want to be able to carry a phone around. I want to be able to take photos easier, et cetera, et cetera. But how it all came together, it happened because somebody invented on behalf of the consumer. So I think that would be the best way to look at it. And I mean, unfortunately, I cannot really go into details of our projects, but we just had a great first half. I would like to also shout out to my team, to Esra, to Vivek, to Kavit, to Arun, to my product team. And after one of those successful projects, our VP, Bobby, he actually made a comment. He said, "This is such a brilliant solution, and I really doubt any single person could have asked your team to build this like that." Right? It really came from the team. It was a brilliant solution, and it came. It turned out that way because our team really owned the problem. We really tried to look into the problem itself as if it's our problem. And another important bit is obviously every time I say a problem or challenge, I would also link that to a certain KPI or outcome, right? I mean, you have a problem or a challenge which prevents you from reaching a certain outcome or KPI. And then when you own that space, as a product team, that's where the access comes from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a key difference from, as you mentioned, like, you know, receiving a ticket, being in this order ticket capability, kind of checking the box, and being relatively kind of, I don't know, different ways of phrasing that, maybe agnostic or naive to the problem, not having a deep understanding of the problem and not having, you know, really that core accountability to the KPI in the end as well. To the solution, I think that's an excellent overview, and I totally get you can't get into details there, but nevertheless, I feel like that feedback about, you know, this is a solution that couldn't have been asked for. It's a really interesting way of illustrating that. So you're also in a PM role. And by the way, I've worked as a PM in the past too. So I know some of the we can call them daily joys, or I don't know, but some of the things that go on in the life of a PM, you kind of need to be sort of an org chart whisperer, or you need to be able to, do a lot of facilitation and, sometimes even lobbying. There's, you know, all kinds of things that come up. So how do you bridge between internal teams? Like, I think you were presenting recently about horizontal initiatives. I had a look at your slides about that. They were really interesting. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. First of all, it's really funny you say bridges. I know a couple of people would now ask me in the following days, are you scripting all these conversations? because I just had an internal post. After I finished an internal training, Adidas is a great training for senior managers, and I just finished that. And at the end of that training, you are expect one of the expected outcomes is that you write an internal like blog post to share your experience. And the title of my blog post was Building Bridges Within Adidas. So, I guess it's a universal need since you also picked that exact phrase. And yeah, like you said, I recently joined, I think in May, the Product-Led Summit, where I had a chance to present my thoughts around leading horizontal initiatives. And again, a big shout out to Ruth and the Product-Led team for organizing that. So building bridges, I think it's a tricky word. I think it's important to really understand why we find ourselves in those situations. I mean, why we need the bridges in the first place. Mm-hmm. And I think it has a lot to do with the companies getting bigger and everybody really focusing on their respective areas. And sometimes it gets harder and harder to move the needle on your own. And then you really need many people to come together behind certain initiatives to take your company or enterprise to the next level, or to take your KPI to the next level, right? I mean, if you are fully pragmatic. So what I observe with most people, they think by talking to these other teams, they can actually take care of this. Like they think, most people think the problem lies with the fact that nobody knows what the other teams are working. I think that's part of the story. And don't take me wrong, I think there's great value in these interactions. Like, I'm a big fan of casual coffee chats. I think there's a lot of things you can discover by just having a simple coffee or tea, if you're not into caffeine. Even a 15-minute conversation can give you a lot of insights and can open the door for a lot of opportunities. What I would suggest, and what I try to do though, is I try to build these bridges by telling a story. So instead of trying to build the bridges for the sake of building bridges, because we think the bridges would help us do more, I think the important thing is to come up with a narrative. Because what unites people is an opportunity. It's a threat. It's a story. It's a narrative. When people see that there's something happening bigger than their own bubble, they're attracted to it. And then when you have this narrative well established, and well communicated and constantly communicated, I think that's when the building these bridges gets much easier. So it is true that the product manager's life is not exactly easy, like you said, because we have to interact with all these teams. And yeah, it's taking the toll sometimes, right? When we both work from home, my wife just says, you speak too much. You just talk way too much, right? And she's right. And that's the price of being in this role. But it's not as difficult as it sounds, in the sense that we need to understand as product managers, we are in the best position to create these narratives than to pull people into this. And the founder of LinkedIn, I listened to Ray Hoffman, I think. I listened to his podcast, Masters of Scale. In one of those, he was talking about founders. And he says the founders are like the drummers of a band, right? They constantly give the right rhythm. They constantly give the right rhythm for everyone to build around it. And I think all this org chart chaos and all these seemingly impossible bridges to be built are actually not that hard to build.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to unpack here. Like, because it raises the question, like, yeah, why, as you mentioned, why do these bridges need to be built in the first place? And I'm just thinking in my head, I mean, I'm stepping a bit out of my wheelhouse here, but from what I think I can remember from history class as a teenager, you know, bureaucracy originated in China, and it was an innovation, and it was, you know, it helped things happen to compartmentalize and specialize to a certain extent. And yet now everyone talks about silos, and things feel, I don't know, over compartmentalized, or people often associate bureaucracy as the opposite of innovation. But yeah, to your point, talking in and of itself isn't the cure. That's the storylines are so important, that things are comprehensible, memorable, that people understand the significance, because otherwise you're just creating lots of noise and over communicating. You know, if you can't tell a story about it, it's almost a test, like probably not right to share that with a person. But
and talking about silos, I think we are also sometimes giving those silos more credit than they deserve. And what do I mean by that? I think it's kind of natural, these silos separate, right? I mean, sooner or later, if your company has tens of thousands of people, I mean, how are you going to manage this, right? Mm. And every time we talk about silos, I actually talk about this example. And this one is 100% my example.
Okay.
So if you think about all the groceries you do in a supermarket, I mean, there could not be an environment where you could observe silos in a better way, right? Mm-hmm. Because the person who grows tomatoes, they don't care about anything else. They grow some tomatoes. You raise chickens to get eggs. You don't care. Some companies produce cheese. I don't know. Some companies produce pasta, et cetera, et cetera. But think about it as a consumer. When you walk into the supermarket, are you telling to yourself, oh my God, I cannot believe we have all these silos and all these people are creating all these things without talking to each other? Mm. No. I mean, it doesn't even cross your mind. You go into the supermarket, you have everything you need. Mm. Because there's someone, there's an orchestrator, which is the supermarket operator in this example, who makes sure these silos interact in the best way so that the consumer, the end user, can enjoy the totality of all the work, all the individual work, all these silos produce. So in that sense, I don't necessarily think silos are bad per se. I think what is usually missing is we don't always have the right setup to show how these silos produce a meaningful whole. And I think that's where we should be focusing on rather than constantly bashing the silos. Yes. Do we have too many silos? Yes. Should it get less? Yes. Can we get rid of them? I doubt it. Mm-hmm. And in the other areas of life, I also see lots of silos. But as long as you manage to make them work for the greater good, I think it's not a problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think those are wise words there. And I'm just looking at the time. We're coming up on our time box. So before I let you go, I want to jump on one last topic here. People talk about the CMO role, and it has a famously short lifespan. And some people say it's shifting toward like chief technology officer, or because of the vast amount of MarTech out there and how technical marketing inherently is these days. And some people say that it's shifting more toward the financial officer because it's so core to a business. It's typically a pretty big item on the balance sheet. And I mean, what do you think about statements like this? Where do you stand?
Yeah. So in my view, it's the marketing topic, which is becoming more of a CTO topic or more of a CFO topic. Yes, there's a big responsibility that falls on the CMOs to communicate this better. But I was also, I think it was a Harvard Business Review article where I also saw how short the average tenure for a CMO is. So that's the thing. Like, I think CMOs are getting a lot of heat, which they don't necessarily deserve. And at the same time, I think they need to get better at the technology topics, or they need to get better at explaining themselves to the finance organization. But at the same time, I also see the marketing is really becoming more of a CTO topic or more of a CFO topic. What do I mean by that? Especially with all the privacy concerns and all the data regulations, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. The CTOs really have to be hands-on when it comes to digital marketing activities. And maybe it's also about time we stop saying digital marketing, because all marketing, pretty much all marketing, became digital these days. So the CTOs, and I'm somewhat experiencing that, right? I mean, if you think about our product team, in the end, my engineers would report into a CTO, right? Mm-hmm. So that would already give you an idea about how all these topics are becoming more and more technology-driven topics. So in that sense, the CTOs are getting involved more and more, and it will only increase. And similarly, on the CFO side of the things, I also think, and yeah, I'm probably stepping out of my grade here, like talking about C-level topics, but still, I would like to share my perspective. Another thing I observe is also, I think CMOs, chief marketing officers, need more flexibility when it comes to funding. And what do I mean by that? We are not living in 80s, 90s, or early 2000s, where you could just create a yearly plan and stick to it. Mm. I'm also thinking there are more and more real-time opportunities for digital marketing, which you could not have with TV advertising, with billboard advertising, with radio advertising, et cetera, et cetera. You can really tap into people's lives via all these advertising platforms, et cetera, et cetera, like TikToks, or Reels, Threads, Twitter, whatever, whichever you prefer. And in order to take these real-time actions, I think the understanding of the CFO when it comes to marketing activities also needs to be at a very high level. Mm. That's why I'm thinking the marketing cannot be really left to a specific function anymore. I think it should be like a side function for everyone in the organization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So having that awareness or responsibility, or having this kind of just baked into more roles there. It's an interesting idea. And yeah, to your point, I mean, Yeah, it's not like TV planning or, you know, planned media buying, scheduled media buys or stuff like this. It's so real time. It's so dynamic. There's much more kind of interactivity. You know, like if you're advertising, as soon as you're advertising on social media, like that is like a living organism that you're participating in, or an ecosystem or something like that. It's so different than.
I would just refer to your post about Amazon Prime and how it's going to affect the PPC, right? Mm-hmm. Or I don't know. I think you mentioned how are they called? Temu?
Temu or yeah.
Temu, yeah. Temu entering the game, mm-hmm. and how things are changing suddenly, right? And how can you foresee this?
No, it's not foreseeable for sure. And yeah. I think I've just about got to let you go, sadly, because I'm really enjoying the conversation. But any final words or last thoughts you want to leave us with?
Thanks a lot for having me. It's my first podcast ever, so
really?
it's a great honor to be here. And when it comes to fellow product managers or aspiring product managers, please do find me on LinkedIn and let's connect. I really like to share my learnings. And and just make sure if you are into digital marketing, just make sure you check all Mike's posts on LinkedIn. I learn a lot from them.
Thanks for plugging me. I appreciate that. I can't believe it's your first podcast. First of many, I'm sure. I think once people hear you, they'll want you on their shows too.
Thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
Thank you too.
Yeah, bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening to Growing E-Commerce. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please consider sharing it with coworkers, friends, or within your professional network. We really appreciate it. This podcast is produced by Smarter E-Commerce, also known as SMEC. To learn more, visit smarter-ecommerce.com.